MFK Fisher once wrote, "Having bowed to the inevitability of the dictum that we must eat to live, we should ignore it and live to eat." Ms. Fisher was one of the greatest and most influential food writers of the 20th century, and she made meals a cause for gastronomical celebration, raising not only cooking but eating well to the level of an art form. During the winter of 1970, a confluence of events brought her together with two other like-minded people, Julia Child and James Beard, at Child's home in the south of France. MFK Fisher's grandnephew, Luc Barre, has written a book about that winter called Provence 1970. It's published by Clarkson Potter, and I'm very pleased that it brings him to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
So how did this book come about? Did you find her notes about that time?
No, actually, it started with a story I wrote for Travel and Leisure magazine. I'm an editor at TNL, and I did a piece where I went to Aix-en-Provence and sort of traced my great-aunt's footsteps there in Aix. And I just happened to then go to La Pichune, which is about an hour and a half east of Aix. And when I was there, I came across, I happened to discover as I was researching that, that she had been there in November, December 1970, and so had everyone else. So once I found, I wrote that in the story, that was the germ of the idea.
And were they there by design?
No, they were there pretty much by accident. These people sort of knew each other, but they weren't really great friends yet, exactly. And so they communicated, they wrote each other letters, and it just so happened. Well, Julia Child had just finished launching Mastering the Art of Cooking, Volume 2, and was going on vacation after that.
Well, and she was a big TV star by that time.
She was a big TV star. And so she said to everyone, listen, we're going to France for Christmas. Come too. And so Judith Jones and Evan Jones, her husband, said, yes, we'll come too. Judith was her editor at Knopf. And MF, who was already planning to do this trip to France with her sister, who's my grandmother, they said, oh, well, yes, we'll stop by too. We're renting a little place nearby.
And you call her MF?
The K is
Kennedy?
Yes, the K is Kennedy. I call her MF in the book. In our family, we call her Dote. So growing up, I called her Dote. And that's sort of her nickname inside the family. But then otherwise, I would say MF, yeah.
So let's talk about her. You describe her as epitomizing a kind of post-war grown-up glamour. What gave you that impression?
Well, maybe my impression is colored a little bit by the fact that I was a kid when I knew her. So she seemed very sophisticated and grown up to me. I grew up in California in the 70s, in the Bay Area, and she lived up in Glen Ellyn, Sonoma County, and so did my grandmother. So we went up there quite a lot and would stop by the last house, which was her house in Glen Ellyn.
And her journals were published just before she died. Did you rely on them for some of this research?
The journal that I found I discovered digging. This is sort of a dramatic event for me. I mean, it's not actually dramatic, but when you're researching a story like this, you look at everything you can get your hands on, all the letters that people wrote. And I did get into my great aunt's sort of storage. My cousin Kennedy, who's MF's younger daughter, has a storage locker basically with all of this material, and I just dug through that for hours and hours, and I found her 1970 journal. So that was a very important coup for me because it gave me an insight into her kind of, it was almost stream of consciousness writing really what was going on with her. I also, very fortunately, MF was carrying on this long-distance love affair with Arnold Gingrich, the founding editor of Esquire, and it was a kind of a chaste relationship, except that they wrote each other. I mean, it was romantic, but they would write each other letters every single day, including when they were on vacation. So that turned out to be very, very important in my research, that I found these daily letters that MF was writing. What is she doing tomorrow? Who came to lunch? And what did she talk about with Beard? All of this was in these daily letters. So that was very fortunate in my research.
MF once wrote, like most humans, I'm hungry. Our three basic needs for food and security and love are so mixed and mingled and intertwined that we cannot straightly think of one without the others. So it happens that when I write of hunger, I'm really writing about love and the hunger for it. And she did have a rather complicated love life. Did she married three times?
She was married three times. She had multiple affairs. There's all sorts of yes, indeed, that is the case. It was a complicated life. And you know,
did the relationship with Gingrich ever become a full fledged affair?
No, it was. It lasted a long time. Gingrich was married. His wife was sort of my impression. She was a sort of bedridden and alcoholic or something like that. But he came out and visited her a few times, and then he ended up. He died, I think, in the mid-70s, so it didn't turn into anything more than a correspondence, I think.
Well, despite the three marriages, wasn't she effectively a single mother for much of her life?
She was, and in fact, so was my grandmother. She divorced, you know, she had three kids, including my dad, who was her oldest son, and then divorced. So the two sisters actually went on these grand trips to France and to Switzerland in the 50s and 60s with their kids together. And they would go for a year. They would go for 6 months. They would go on boats. You know, I grew up hearing these stories about from my uncles and my father about, you know, going on the boat for you know, a month over to through the Panama Canal and to Europe. That in a way, that's also a germ of why I wrote this book, is hearing those stories about France in the 50s and the kids riding around, reading Tintin comics in French and riding Solex bicycles and all this kind of stuff. That's what drew me to do that story about Provence.
Rather privileged, actually.
Yes. I mean, it's funny. People have asked me, so were they fabulously wealthy? You know, and I'm not, or my family is not. But it was a time in the mid, I think, you know, the dollar was strong. And in the 1950s, if you want, you know, you could live very, very well in France. Another example of that is, you know, Richard Olney, who's another main character in my book, less well known than some of the others, but a sort of fascinating guy.
Well, one of the great writers of French recipes in English.
Yes, a brilliant writer. I mean, a wonderful writer, and willing, and he was willing to be sort of cantankerous and misanthropic, which when you're writing a book like this one, is kind of nice to have someone say bitter, cruel, bitchy things. And he certainly did that.
Well, he seems resentful of the fact that the others are all more famous than he is, even though he was such an important writer.
Right, right, exactly. And it's also probably just a personality thing in a way, too.
That's why he wasn't more successful, because everybody fell in love with Julia Child, for example.
Right, right. That's the thing. Julia was, of all of them, I mean, of course, she was on television, but it's interesting to think about Julia in a way on television, because she's not an obvious TV star when you think about her. She was very, very tall and a little bit awkward, and she had a strange voice and all these things. And she seems somehow kind of, you know, she was able to be incredibly entertaining and yet also be totally real, and like you felt like you knew her. She wasn't pretending about anything.
Was your grandmother a good cook?
She was a wonderful
So the
cook.
Sisters were good cooks. Well, how did MF wind up becoming so knowledgeable? Did she have any formal training?
No. I think that's a good question. She went to France very, very, she married very, very young. Went to France. Her then husband was a grad student in Dijon, France, and so she ended up spending a lot of time alone because he was off studying, wandering around Dijon, and then writing. And then she got those things published very early. I mean, she was in her 20s when her early works were published.
And when did she wind up writing for The New Yorker?
I guess mostly in the 50s and 60s is when she was writing columns for The New Yorker. I should take that. I'm probably earlier, too, for all I know. The pieces that I read when I was researching this book were ones in the 60s. But
she was a wonderful writer. W.H. Auden once said of her, "I do not know of anyone in the United States who writes better prose."
But, you know, it's interesting, and related to The New Yorker, that I find that when you read those pieces she wrote for The New Yorker, there's a kind of opacity and a They're wonderful pieces, but they're very ethereal, let's say, and writerly. And you know, it's that style of The New Yorker kind of writing from the 50s and 60s. But then when you would read her letters, when I was reading her letters for this book, and a lot of material that I based on my book mostly on the letters were extremely direct and funny and full of gossip and humor and a very different kind of voice.
Well, Sean liked a certain kind of writing, and right. He didn't like people who he thought might sound a bit vulgar, with people who use the word I when they wrote articles about themselves.
Right.
My guest is Luc Barr, who's an editor at Travel and Leisure. And he's written a book called Provence 1970, MFK Fisher, Julia Child, James Beard, and the Reinvention of American Taste. So here we have these giants, as it turns out, all together. Did they talk a lot about food?
They did. They were, you know, they would have whole conversations about green peppercorns or how the goose was much less fatty in France as compared to America and so forth. And I this is all recorded in their various letters to each other, and I use quotes from those letters and insert them into the recreation of these scenes. Of course, I don't really know exactly what was said at any given dinner, but I'm just using contemporaneous material from their letters and diaries to show you what was on their minds and what they were talking about.
Did they influence each other? Because MF and James Beard spent a lot of time together during that winter.
I think so. I mean, if you think about, my book is a recreation of this moment in time, but it also is an argument about food and about how we think about food. And one of the things that keeps coming up thematically in this book and at that time was their relationship with France. You know, they had all fallen in love with food originally going to France. They all, and I have a chapter in the book that describes this, you know, that feeling of having a piece of crusty French bread and French butter, unlike anything that you could find in America in 1935 or whatever year it was. And for each of them, there was that moment. They had it, whether it was in the late 1920s or in the 40s or the 50s, they had that seminal moment in France of discovering amazing food.
Go ahead.
Well, and yet now in 1970, at the time my book takes place, that's all changing a little bit because the 60s has happened, and they're a little more impatient now with this sort of continental snobbery and the proper way of making a sauce and all this sort of thing.
And they'd also played a role in changing American attitudes toward food.
Absolutely.
And somebody like James Beard was more American in his outlook. Julia Child was probably the purest French chef. Once, when I was interviewing her with Jacques Pepin, I asked, which one of you is more of a purist? And they both said Julia, definitely.
Really? That's funny.
She wanted to stick very closely to the way the French did it, and Jacques is very happy to go off in all sorts of different directions. He'd become much more Americanized.
Right. Well, also, but this is, again, in my book, this is the moment when Julia splits up with Simone Beck, who was her co-author on those two great books about French cooking. And she's ready in 1970 to go in a new direction. She's ready to make, you know, a New England clam chowder. She wants to try out an Indian curry, whatever. So the book is about this transitional moment where American food is kind of coming into its own. And the fact that Beard, for example, is then, okay, it's a little bit comic because here he is set up in this diet clinic in Provence, surrounded by people who are cooking this amazing food, trying to lose weight. Of course, he fails to lose any weight at all. And he's also trying to finish his grand opus, American Cookery, which is going to be for American food what Mastering the Art of French Cooking was for French food. He wants that to be the case. And yes, he had done all this research on regional cooking and, you know, tremendous deep dive into American cooking in a serious way.
You describe the Child's kitchen in Provence as a free-for-all, a happy, casual, slightly tipsy melee where everyone seemed to be talking at once. Well, who's doing the cooking?
Well, they were all doing a little bit of the cooking. I think Julia was in charge. But Julia and Beard, they love to cook together. They had a sort of joking nickname for each other, the Gigis, taking the J's from their names. And they would be cooking together, making a soup and roasting a chicken or whatever. But, you know, it's interesting. The kitchen is almost identical. Paul Child designed he hung all the kitchen implements on the walls of the kitchen in Provence and in Cambridge. So the original model really is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that was a real test kitchen where Julia Child would be testing out recipes. And it was very scientific and strict. Whereas in Provence, it's not a test kitchen. It's just they're on vacation. They're cooking.
Well, a lot of Americans decided to live in France as expats. In fact, in the next hour, I'll be talking to Patricia Wells, who lives in Provence in Paris. But all of these people, despite their involvement with French food, chose to live in America. In fact, MFK Fisher pretty much is a Californian.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And that's in a way, the emotional heart of my story is following MF's following her. She's my main, you know, focus in this book.
Well, she is your relative.
And she is my great aunt. She's in France. She loves France. She's very, you know, sort of having this nostalgic trip back to France. But she's also at the same time building her her house in Glen Ellyn in Sonoma County. But she's – and this is why it was so important that I found those diaries, because it's in those diaries that I found her saying, you know, I always thought that I would end up dying in Provence on a steep hillside with olive trees. And she can visualize that. That's where she was going to end up. She always thought that. And then here she was – deciding, you know what, it's not to be. I'm going to go back to California.
And you mentioned earlier that's because they saw this as the twilight of snobbery.
Well, I think that they had grown impatient with the sort of snobbery that in my book, you know, you see Richard Olney is a terrific snob, a wine snob, you know, a very knowledgeable, judgmental. Sybil Bedford, who's a writer, also a friend of MF's, is also similarly, a terrific snob. So, and I have, some conflict. There is some conflict in the book about that. And it has to do with how much respect is to be accorded the traditional French methodologies.
Well, how much of this is a foreigner's take on France? The French aren't necessarily snobs. I mean, they can be purists about things and be very and do everything possible, almost jingoistically French. But this kind of snobbery was like Americans and Brits who are in the know.
Yeah, I think maybe there's some truth to that. There's the sense a European, a Frenchman, a Frenchwoman would just assume, you know. Simone Beck is an example of this. She was not a snob particularly, but she certainly believed that the French knew how to cook and that proper cooking was French cooking and that a great restaurant is a great French restaurant. All those things sort of go without saying. And I think at this point people are starting to question that a little bit.
Well, French food can be pretty great.
Oh, I
French
agree.
Restaurants can be pretty great.
Oh, I agree.
And as we see in other parts of the world, in Mexico, they cook Mexican food, but they use French techniques these days.
Mm-hmm.
French techniques have pretty much come to dominate much of the world's cooking.
French food is, you have no quarrel with me. I find French food to be wonderful. But I would also say, let's go, you know, back in 1970, Alice Waters is 2 years away from launching Chez Panisse. And she's not a trained chef. She didn't go to school. She did not do her apprenticeship for 5 years at some French restaurant the way that one traditionally did. So you can see that, and in Berkeley, California, that this kind of countercultural bohemian kind of cooking and attitude is coming into being at this moment.
Although she does name her restaurant after a character in a Pagnol novel,
right,
in Provence. Luc Barr will be speaking with Francis Lamb, giving a reading, and a six-course dinner will be served this Sunday at 5 o'clock at Calliope at 84 East 4th Street. For reservation information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book is Provence 1970, M.F.K. Fisher, Julia Child, James Beard, and the Reinvention of American Taste. It is published by Clarkson Potter. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.